listeners, welcome to The Book Report. I'm your host, Elaine Charles, and I'm so pleased you're joining me during this busy time. If you were really lucky this past week, one of the gifts you received is a trip in the coming year. If not, during one of the holiday reunions you attended, perhaps you reconnected with a family member or friend, and the two of you have begun to map out a trip together. Or, getting out of your comfort zone and exploring the world is high on your list of New Year's resolutions. Today's show will be a global getaway. Books about all sorts of different trips, far-flung countries and cultures worth exploring. I'm thrilled to have Alexander McCall Smith as my guest. We'll be speaking about Botswana and his cast of characters from the beloved number one ladies detective agency. So let's begin as we turn to page one of the book report. Strange Stones is a far-ranging, thought-provoking collection of Peter Hessler's best reportage. Powerful storytelling with shrewd cultural insights, presented with the warm sense of humor that is the trademark of his work. Over the last decade, as an author and staff writer for The New Yorker, Hessler has lived in Asia and the U.S., writing as both a native and knowledgeable outsider in these two very different regions. This unusual perspective distinguishes the book. For example, Wild Flavor invites listeners along on a taste test between two rat restaurants in South China. One story profiles Yao Ming, basketball star and one of China's most beloved exports. Another, David Spindler, an obsessive and passionate historian of the Great Wall. While Hessler's subjects and locations vary, thematic links bind the pieces. The strength of local traditions, the surprising overlap between apparently opposing cultures, and the powerful lessons drawn from individuals of different worlds. George Backman narrates.
"Do you want a big rat or a small rat?" the waitress says. "I'm getting used to making difficult decisions in Luogang. It's a small village in southern China's Guangdong province, and I came here on a whim, having heard that Luogang has a famous rat restaurant. Upon arrival, however, I discovered that there are actually two celebrated restaurants, the highest-ranking Wild Flavor restaurant and the new Eight Sceneries Wild Flavored Food City. Both restaurants specialize in rat. They have the same bamboo and wood decor. They are next door to each other, and their owners are named Zhong and Zhong, respectively. Virtually everybody in Luogang village is named Zhong. The restaurant Zhongs are not related, and the competition between them is keen. As a foreign journalist, I've been cajoled to such an extent that, in an effort to please both Zhongs, I agreed to eat two lunches, one at each restaurant. But before the taste test can begin, I have to answer the question that's been posed by the waitress at the highest-ranking Wild Flavor restaurant. Her name is Zhong. In Chinese, it means bell. She asks the question again. Do you want a big rat or a small rat? What's the difference, I say. The big rats eat grass stems, and the small ones eat fruit. This piece of information does not help much. I try a more direct tack. Which tastes better? Both of them taste good. Which do you recommend? Either one. I glance at the table next to mine. Two parents, a grandmother and a little boy, are having lunch. The boy is gnawing on a rat drumstick. I can't tell if the drumstick once belonged to a big rat or a small rat. The boy eats quickly. It's a warm afternoon. The sun is shining. I make my decision. Small rat, I say.
That was a sampling of Strange Stones by Peter Hessler. Alexander McCall Smith has written more than 100 books. including academic titles, short story collections, and immensely popular children's books. But he is best known for his acclaimed number one ladies detective agency series. Perhaps you've seen the delightful HBO series, which aired in 2009. McCall Smith is the author of several other series, including one featuring female sleuth Isabella Dalhousie. Look for the 10th mystery in that series, The Strange Habits of Happiness, in spring 2015. McCall Smith's newest series for kids is based on the adventures of the beloved Precious Ramotswe as a little girl. McCall Smith was born in Rhodesia, now Zimbabwe, and was educated there and in Scotland. He became a law professor in Scotland and returned to Africa to work in Botswana, where he helped establish a law school at the University of Botswana. For many years, he was professor of medical law at the University of Edinburgh and a visiting professor at numerous other universities. In addition to his university work, McCall Smith has been the vice chairman of the Human Genetics Commission in the UK, the chairman of the British Medical Journal Ethics Committee, and a member of the International Bioethics Commission of UNESCO. McCall Smith currently lives in Edinburgh. His hobbies include playing wind instrument. In fact, he is the co-founder of an amateur orchestra called the Really Terrible Orchestra. He's also written several librettos, including one for the Okavango Macbeth, set among a troop of baboons in the Okavango Delta, which has been staged in Africa and the UK. Today we'll speak with him about the Handsome Man's Deluxe Cafe, 15 in the adventures of Ma Ramotswe, Ma Makutsi, and the gang. Welcome, Alexander. It's such a thrill to have you with us on the Book Report.
Thank you very much indeed, Lynn.
First and foremost, my congratulations on adding a brilliant new adjective to our language, Makutsian, marked by a tendency to be a bit prickly and wear fancy shoes. I have a friend or two who would proudly wear that label. So thank you for that.
Well, I'm delighted that you're using that word. I'm very pleased that a couple of the words that I've used in the number one ladies detective agency have passed into usage, if not common usage, at least into usage. So traditionally built for people of a certain size, generous size. I like that description. And indeed, many traditionally built people have said to me, thank you for that description. Makutsian is another one. It's rarer than traditionally built, but it does express exactly what you've said it expresses.
And also garagist.
Yes, garagist is a nice pretentious way of saying mechanic. I think that it's rather fun to occasionally resort to pretentious expressions, and garagist is one. But don't call mechanics garagists to their faces. They may not appreciate it.
The Handsome Man's Deluxe Cafe is number 15 in the adventures of Ma Ramotswe, Ma Makutsi, Ra JLB Matakoni, and the gang. Where did the inspiration for this particular story evolve from?
Well, I wanted to take Ma Makutsi's story on a bit. As you know, she's the assistant to Ma Ramotswe, and she, I think, is thinking of spreading her wings a bit, because she's married Mr. Futi Radafuti, who's got a bit of money, so her position is a little bit more comfortable, and she thinks she'll start a business on the side. So what does she do but start exactly the wrong sort of business, which is a restaurant, because we all know that restaurants are a veil of tears. There are all sorts of difficulties that crop up with restaurants. The chef is usually wanted by the police. The waiters are often drunk. That sort of problem. And so things get a little bit difficult for Ma Makutsi, but they're sorted out. Because in these books, as in all my books, the ending is always a happy one.
And we thank you for that. Now, fans of Ma Makutsi will be disturbed to learn that she is in danger of relinquishing her gold standard at the Botswana Secretarial College. A student is about to achieve a 98%. I'm wondering how Ma Makutsi can weather this storm.
Well, that obviously is something that we've all been worried about, because we know that she's very proud indeed of her 97% grade at the Botswana Secretarial College, never before equaled. And now there's a danger that somebody is going to get 98%. Of course, it's been coming. We must have realized that this was coming, because no record lasts forever. And even 97% obviously is vulnerable to 98%, 99%, or indeed 100%. Nobody, I think, will ever get 100% at the Botswana Secretarial College, but I'm sorry to say that her record is now threatened with this 98%. She's brave. She takes it on the chin. She is accepting of it. She's philosophical, but it hurts.
Do you think this has had any impact on Mama Kutsi in a way that is now making her divine messages from her shoes?
I don't think that the disturbance of the 97% record is having too much effect in that respect, because Mama Kutsi's shoes have talked to her for a long time. I never thought that I would write books in which one of the characters would have her shoes talk to her, but I found that that's happened. And it's rather fun. It's happened really by accident. I was writing a particular page and suddenly the shoes came in with a comment. I think that if we imagine what our shoes would say to us, if they could speak, I think we probably would imagine they'd be quite critical or complaining. Her shoes complain quite a bit, and indeed they criticize her on various scores. So it's fun. It's a ridiculous conceit, but it's great fun.
I was intrigued to read that Mama Kutsi and the character Charlie were actually having a discussion about sexism. In Southern Africa today, would this conversation actually occur?
Yes, I think it probably would, because there's been great progress in Southern African countries such as Botswana, where these books have been set, giving women a much fairer deal in society. And certainly if you compare the situation today with the situation a few decades ago, it's very different, and women are less constrained by a patriarchal society. Obviously, there is still progress to be made, and I suspect that there are many women there who feel that they've still got a lot of battles to fight on this particular front. But generally, there has been very, very good progress. So I think it's quite likely that Mama Kutsi and the apprentice Charlie, who's a fairly typical young man in many respects, would have this conversation in which Mama Kutsi would have to point out to him that some of his attitudes need looking at. So I think that's realistic.
We're speaking with Alexandra McCall-Smith on The Book Report.
The book actually has a serious topic at its core, domestic abuse. How have Southern African women changed in how they are treated?
Well, I think that, again, there's probably been a lot of progress made in recent decades in dealing with the problem of violence within the home. And certainly within South Africa, there's been a lot of enlightened development. Their constitutional law and their law relating to human rights has been tremendously improved. And so I think the position of people who are vulnerable to bullying by other people is much better than it was. Now, obviously, there's still a lot of work to be done in that area, and I think people are doing that. So I would be inclined to say that now it's a bit more difficult for a man to bully a woman in any circumstances. It's a bit more difficult for them to bully people in the workplace than it used to be, and it's probably a bit more difficult to bully people within the home, although the situation is far from ideal. So I have dealt with it in this book. These books are lighthearted and cheerful books, but often there's underneath the surface there's quite a serious issue. And as you say, this one of a woman being subjected to domestic abuse is present there. And happily, Mara Motswe is able to help this woman.
Yes. Your books make us feel that people from Botswana are scrupulously honest, moral, patriotic, and law-abiding. When you visit the country today, does it feel the same to you?
I think that there are very many fine qualities in Botswana. I remember feeling when I first visited Botswana, which was back really in 1980, I remember feeling that. You crossed the border into Botswana and you felt immediately that you were in a good place. And indeed, Botswana had a very good record since independence in 1966. They enshrined in their political culture, their social culture, a lot of good values. So it is a good place. It's probably the least corrupt country in Africa, and it's probably the best run country in Africa, and it's the country in Africa which has by and large the best record in respect of protecting people. Now, having said all that, obviously every country has its faults, nowhere's perfect, and the society that I first saw when I went to Botswana all those years ago will have changed to an extent. Every society changes. There's a move from the countryside to the cities, which of course brings fairly significant social change and changes in people's attitudes towards other people. But having said all that, I still discern in Botswana, when I go back as I do every year, I still see the same good qualities. They're still there. In other words, people still treat one another, it seems to me, with decency and courtesy in the small transactions of life. And that impresses people who visit Botswana. So there are changes, yes, and the modern world brings with it, I suppose, things that are less desirable than one might wish. People, I suppose, might be a bit more impatient. They might be a bit more materialistic, and so on.
How do you juggle the writing of your various series?
Well, there's a season for each of the series, and so because I write 4 or 5 books a year, I have to have my time allocated quite carefully. And so I write each book in its season, which will be a period of 2 or 3 months, and then I move on to the next one.
Any final thoughts about The Handsome Man's Deluxe Cafe?
Well, this book is the 15th book. The Handsome Man's Deluxe Cafe is the 15th book in the series. We've still got a lot of things to talk about in relation to the number one ladies' detective agency. We've got to sort out those apprentices. It's about time they finished their apprenticeship, but they've been going on for a long time. We've got a lot of matters that Mara Motsui still wants to address. So I think she's still there. I feel her presence as strongly as I felt it at the beginning of the series, and she's still the person I knew at the beginning of the series. She's still the same person I would like to sit down and have a cup of Red Bush tea with and talk about the world, because she's a very wise woman. She's a lovely presence. I like her very much indeed, and I can listen to her for a very long time, and I hope that she'll still be with us for a long time too.
Your fans love her, too. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you very much indeed, Elaine. Thank you.
And now let's listen to a sampling of a book that takes us on a brief, delightful visit to Botswana. The Handsome Man's Deluxe Cafe, narrated by Lisette Lecat.
Once up and about, clasping her cup of freshly brewed Red Bush tea in her hand, she took a walk around the garden, savoring the freshness of the early morning air. Some people said that the air in the morning had no smell. She thought they were wrong, for it smelled of so many things, of the acacia leaves that had been closed for the night and were now opening at the first touch of the morning sun, of a wood fire somewhere, just a hint of it, of the wind and the breath that the wind had, which was dry and sweet, like the breath of cattle. It was while she was standing there that she decided whether the day would be one in which things might happen. It had something to do with the way she felt when she considered the day ahead. And most of the time she was right, although sometimes, of course, she could be completely wrong. On that particular morning, as she walked past the mopipi tree she'd planted at the front of the garden, she had a sudden feeling that the next few hours were going to be rather unusual. It was not a disturbing premonition, not one of those feelings that one gets when one fears that something is going to go badly wrong. It was more a feeling that something interesting and out of the ordinary lay ahead. She remarked on the fact to Mr. J.L.B. Matokoni, as he sat at the kitchen table eating the brown maize porridge that he liked so much. Puso and his sister Motolele had already eaten their breakfast and were in their rooms preparing to leave for school. The school run that Maramotswe had become so used to was now no longer necessary, as Puso was of an age to make his own way there. The school wasn't far away, and he was also able to help his sister with the wheelchair. This gave the children an independence that they both enjoyed, although departing on time could be a problem when Puso had some boyish task to complete, the catching of flying ants, for instance. Or Motolele had, at the last minute, to find another pair of cotton socks, or locate a book that needed to be returned to the school library. "I have a feeling," announced Maramotswe, "that this is going to be a busy day." Mr. J.L.B. Matukoni glanced up from his porridge. "Lots of letters to write. Bills to send out." Maramotswe shook her head. "No, we're up to date on all those things, Ra. Mama Kutsi has been busy with her filing, too, and everything is put away."
"Lots of clients to see, then."
He thought of his own day, and imagined a line of driverless, impatient cars, each eager for his attention, their horns honking to attract his notice. Cars, in his view, were quite capable of all the human emotions and failings, including a lack of patience or restraint. Maramotswe had looked at her diary just before leaving the office the previous day and had seen that it was largely empty. "No," she answered. "There are no appointments with clients. Nothing this morning and nothing this afternoon, I think." He looked puzzled.
"And yet it's going to be a busy day?"
"I have that feeling. It's difficult to say why, but I am sure that this will not be a quiet day." Mr. J.L.B. Matukoni smiled. People talked about the intuition of women, but he wasn't sure that he believed in it. How could women possibly know things that men did not know?
That was The Handsome Man's Deluxe Cafe by Alexander McCall Smith. Years ago in Sarajevo, a teenage assassin fired not just the opening shots of the First World War, but, as time would confirm, the starting gun for modern history. By killing Archduke Franz Ferdinand, Gavrilo Princip triggered conflict that would claim millions of lives in battle and turmoil that would change our world. In The Trigger, Tim Butcher uncovers the unreported details of Princip's life and draws upon his own experience as a war reporter in the Balkans in the 1990s. The Trigger, performed by the author, brings to life the moment the world first went to war and spotlights this complex region and its ghosts, past and present.
I took a photograph of an elderly man sitting under an umbrella, shaded from the July sun, as he sold cigarettes, one by one. And then I noticed people occasionally slipping away from the market to visit a stone building on the edge of a nearby cemetery. I went to explore. It was about the size of an electricity substation, a modest structure with a box design, easy to overlook. It wore the livery of so many wartime buildings in Sarajevo, a cavity from what appeared to be an artillery strike, terracotta roof tiles rucked out of alignment, the door ripped from its hinges, its frame pockmarked by shrapnel. I followed the market-goers, and in the summer heat my sense of smell told me from some distance what was going on. They were using it as a makeshift lavatory. My diary recorded it in malodorous detail. The graveyard was unkempt, but I was not prepared for what I found. The floor was just a sea of turds. Amongst the mess were dozens of used sanitary towels, a bra, and lots of rubbish. A tombstone lay smashed in two on the floor, and the light hung wrecked from the ceiling, which had a gaping hole in it. But what made me curious was that the building was clearly some sort of chapel. A cross was visible above the doorway. Why be so disrespectful of a religious site? I found the answer on a piece of black marble set into an external wall. It was a commemoration stone bearing the date 1914 and some Cyrillic text, including a list of names. At the top of the list, in the most prominent position, was one that jumped out at me. Gavrilo Princip. When I went to Sarajevo for the first time as a reporter, a single thought kept coming to me. This was where the event took place that triggered the First World War, the assassination of Archduke Franz Ferdinand by Gavrilo Princip. As a schoolboy, I remember struggling to pronounce the killer's name, but as I grew older, my understanding of the crisis he precipitated became clearer. Millions of lives lost in a clash so colossal it reshaped the world. Yet the Bosnian War of the 1990s seemed far removed from the fighting of the Great War, a localized ethnic conflict in the Balkans, a region synonymous in Western eyes with impenetrability, backwardness, and violence. For much of the 20th century, Bosnia had been one of the component parts of Yugoslavia. But when its leaders in Sarajevo sought to create their own separate country, they clashed with the Serbian authorities who dominated the Yugoslav nation and who opposed the breakup. Tens of thousands were to die in fighting that, if you took away the helicopters, wire-guided missiles, and satellite navigation systems, seemed to belong to an earlier, more brutal age. Deliberate attacks on civilians, torching of homes, systematic rape, genocide. Sarajevo was where many of the Bosnian War's defining horrors took place. In early exchanges, forces commanded by Bosnian Serb hardliners had been able to secure only a few of Sarajevo's peripheral suburbs, so they withdrew to the high ground that presses in on this cupped hand of a city and set about imposing one of the cruelest sieges in modern warfare. The lights went out, taps ran dry, and supplies dwindled to a trickle, condemning 400,000 Sarajevans to survive on the collapsing skeleton of their hometown. Their tormentors suffered no such supply problems and were able to dictate the nature and pace of their assault. With their soldiers on the front lines unable to advance, Bosnian Serb commanders sought to wear down their enemy by pounding them with artillery dug in on the nearby hilltops. When they ran out of military targets, they kept on firing, wantonly destroying religious buildings, assembly halls, hospitals, newspaper offices, libraries. Anything that contributed, no matter how marginally, to Bosnia's nascent sense of national identity. And when they ran out of those, they kept up their barrage, firing with deliberate cruelty, actions that were later to be successfully prosecuted as war crimes, into residential areas. With grim inevitability, many of Sarajevo's bloodiest incidents took place as civilians were cut down by shells when they emerged from cover for essential supplies, queuing for bread, waiting at a standpipe for water, crowding market stalls whenever smugglers made it into the city.
We've just heard The Trigger by Tim Butcher. Jennifer Coburn had always been terrified of dying young. Though she was perfectly healthy, she decided to save up and drop everything to travel with her daughter Katie on a whirlwind European adventure before it was too late. Even though her husband couldn't join them, even though she was nervous about the journey, Jennifer was determined to jam her daughter's mental photo album with memories, just in case. From the cafes of Paris to the top of the Leaning Tower of Pisa, Jennifer and Katie take Europe on one city at a time, united by their desire to see the world and spend precious time together. Kate McIntyre performs this heartwarming generational love story.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. In 20 minutes, we will be landing at Charles de Gaulle Airport in Paris, where the local time is now 7:10 a.m. a calm, disembodied voice announced. Then the flight attendant repeated the information in French. At least I assumed she was repeating the information. For all I knew, she could have been saying, "On our flight this morning is a clueless American mother and her 8-year-old daughter who is counting on her to navigate their 10-day stay in the City of Lights. Good luck with that." I looked at my fellow passengers, noticing I was the only one awake in the cabin, which always seemed to be the case on these red-eye flights. William was back home in San Diego, flossing his teeth. In a few minutes, he would look at the clock beside our bed and realize that Katie's and my flight was landing. 20 seconds later, he would be snoring. As a lifelong insomniac, I try to remember that he isn't purposely taunting me when he goes from 60 to snooze in less than a minute. Still, there are times at night when I stare at him in amazement, wondering how he can let go of consciousness so easily. I heard the clap of lifting window shades and watched light pour into the cabin like spotlights onto a stage. "Good night, William," I thought. "Good morning, Paris. Katie can sleep through earthquakes, so neither the noise nor the plummeting descent of the plane bothered her." Her brown hair was still pressed into her Eeyore neck pillow, and her white Stride-Rite sandals were nestled in the space between our seats. Katie didn't even seem to notice when the flight attendant abruptly pressed the button that snapped her seat into its upright position. My daughter's delicate eyebrows lifted quizzically. She shifted her position slightly and continued sleeping. "Katie," I whispered, "we're landing in a moment. You need to wake up." She blinked open her bleary green eyes, trying to register who I was, where we were, and what I was saying. "We'll be in Paris in a few minutes," I said, wondering if I sounded as relaxed as I hoped I did. As the plane continued to land, I felt a slow panic rising. Katie yawned. "Are you excited, Mommy?" "Oh, yes, Katie. I'm very, very excited," I replied, imitating the voice of a yoga instructor. "And how are you?" "Good," she chirped. I resisted the urge to say anything else, lest Katie know how absolutely, positively freaked out I was. Weeks before we left, I asked Katie if she was looking forward to our trip. "Do you understand how lucky we are to be going to Paris? I mean, do you get it?" She was just finishing up second grade, and her teacher was very focused on the students' comprehension of the words they read. So Katie brought Mrs. Lunsford's lesson home. "Well, Paris is the capital of France, and people say I'm lucky to be going. So I know it's special, but since I've never been there, I don't really understand why it's so great." Katie scrunched her mouth to the side, pondering the tough question. "So I understand it, but I guess I don't get it." On the ground, I cursed my friend Maxime for telling me that Katie and I should take the train from Charles de Gaulle Airport, then delve into the Paris metro system to find our hotel. "It is easy," he told me weeks earlier as we sat at the soup plantation in San Diego. Easy for him because he is, in fact, French. "Did you study the vocabulary words I gave you last week?" He looked disappointed when I told him I hadn't. Sure, he was encouraging, always telling me my accent was très magnifique, but the French are known for being rather finicky about foreigners speaking their language imperfectly. The prospect of speaking French on their home turf was more than a bit intimidating. Maxime assured me that if I just gave it a try, they would appreciate my effort. "So," he continued, "all you know how to say is what?" "Hello, please, and thank you." My friend sighed. A writer with no words.
That was We'll Always Have Paris, a mother-daughter memoir by Jennifer Coburn. An experience definitely worth allegedly having is a collection of travel essays selected by Edith Zimmerman, founder of the offbeat women's website, The Hairpin. Like The Hairpin, these essays are funny, weird, adventurous, and moving. There are stories about following a mysterious stranger's maps in Mexico, attending endless step aerobic classes in Buenos Aires, faking a terrible British accent in London, and navigating a nude spa in Stockholm. They're about loneliness, connection, and sunburn, and about daring ourselves to be brave and bracing being scared. The stories are performed by Cassandra and Danny Campbell.
Despite Otto's example, I continued to speak Spanish like it was a made-up thing, which was awkward, and I don't know why I was so shy and weird. My status in the house was something like a taller fifth son who wasn't the brightest and who snuck into the bathroom really early every morning to take a shower. I knew it was wasteful and the water was freezing, so it was not a pleasure, but I'd started giving off a strange odor, which might have been because of the change in diet or from being anxious in a new place, or maybe with some sort of hellish second puberty visited on dim fifth sons of the house. Every day, I left the house and saw volcanoes, a row of them, blue at the edge of the city, on the walk to school, which I never ceased to find thunder striking, and I'd cross the main city square eating a piece of bread and feeling pretty happy with life. Shayla is the only place where I've ever thought weak instant coffee with lots of sugar stirred into it tasted good. There were tons of stray dogs roaming around the city, and I was fascinated by one guy, clearly homeless and permanently solitary, who walked around everywhere with a pack of them around him in loose formation. I worked on my vocabulary flashcards and translating the story of a shipwrecked sailor. I started to know and recognize all the expats in town. I went to discos and did the Macarena at 3 a.m. with unironic pleasure. I got stupendously drunk a lot. I had almost relationships that included sentences like, "I heard you had diarrhea and bedbugs," which, while accurate, wasn't something I was used to hearing directed my way romantically, and, "I'm confused about monogamy," which sounded more familiar. I took buses different places and tried to describe everything I was seeing. The men in the town wear bright red pants, a striped shirt with a hot pink embroidered collar, and a sort of Panama hat with an embroidered band, etc. Also, I was very sick once in Huehuetenango, and down the block there was a funeral home called La Casa del Último Adiós, and that seemed supremely funny. I don't know why. Qué rico. My last week in Shayla coincided with that of two friends I had made, Layla and Gabe, both from North Carolina, too, and we got this idea to take part in a hike being planned from Shayla to Lake Atitlan. This was a distance of maybe about 50 miles, and that didn't sound too far to walk. We'd been to Lake Atitlan by bus, and it was a short trip. Layla had a crush on one of the guys who was leading the trip, and after a couple of months of eating starchy food and drinking beer, neither of us really fit in our pants anymore. There is no way to emphasize enough how hugely unfit we were for this journey. One thing, it was the rainy season, and I didn't have a raincoat. The way wasn't along any established route, but was mostly an as-the-crow-flies pass up and down mountains and through forests from point A to point B. The morning I was leaving with my gigantic backpack on, the husband of my host family could barely stand up, he was laughing so hard. There were maybe 10 of us on the trip. Layla, Gabe, and I shared a tent, and at the end of the first day, we were so tired and blistered, and it was raining so hard that after we ate dinner, we stuck our plates and forks outside the tent door to wash in the morning. In the night, we heard wild dogs moving through the camp and then finding the plates and licking them clean. And in the morning, we were still so tired, we sat on a log and ate off them anyway. And then we stuck the plates and forks in our giganto backpacks and hiked some more. Ta-da!
We've just heard an experience definitely worth allegedly having, compiled by Edith Zimmerman. Anya von Bremzen, a James Beard award-winning writer, paints a vivid picture of life under the red socialist banner in Mastering the Art of Soviet Cooking, a memoir of food and longing. With sardonic wit, von Bremzen tells an intimate yet epic story of life in the vanished empire known as the USSR, a place where every edible morsel was packed with emotional and political meaning. Born in 1963 in an era of bread shortages, Anya grew up in a communal Moscow apartment where 18 families shared one kitchen. She sang odes to Lenin, Black Marketeer Juicy Fruit Gum, watched her father brew moonshine, and, like most Soviet citizens, longed for a taste of the mythical West. It was a life by turns absurd, drab, joyous, and melancholy, and ultimately intolerable to her anti-Soviet mother. When Anya was 10, Larissa, her mom, took her daughter and fled Brezhnev-era Russia, arriving in Philadelphia with no winter coat and no right of return. Anya occupies two parallel food universes, one where she writes about four-star restaurants, the other where a taste of humble kolbasa transports her back to her scarlet blaze socialist past. To bring that past to life in its full flavor, Anya and her mother Larissa embark on a unique journey. They decide to eat and cook their way through every decade of the Soviet experience, turning Larissa's kitchen into a time machine and an incubator of memories. Kathleen Gatti narrates.
Our experiences, though, featured no happy kitchens enveloped in an idyllic haze of vanilla, no kindly matriarchs setting golden holiday roasts on the table, tea cakes rich in bourgeois butter. I do have such a memory. It's of Mom reading Proust aloud in our Khrushchevian slum, me utterly bored by the Frenchman's sensory reveries, but besotted with the idea of the real edible cookie. What did it taste like? That exotic capitalist Madeleine? I desperately wanted to know. Inevitably, a story about Soviet food is a chronicle of longing, of unrequited desire. So what happens when some of your most intense culinary memories involve foods you hadn't actually tasted? Memories of imaginings, of received histories, feverish collective yearning produced by 70 years of geopolitical isolation and scarcity. Until recently, I didn't talk about such memories much. Asked why I write about food, I'd just rattle off my well-rehearsed story. How my mother and I emigrated from Moscow without my father in 1974, stateless refugees with no winter coats and no right of return. How after I graduated from Juilliard, my piano career was cut short in the late 80s by a wrist injury. And how, searching for a new start, I fell into food, almost by accident, really. And I never looked back. Following my first cookbook, Please to the Table, about the cuisines of the former USSR, nice things kept happening. Exciting magazine stories, more cookbooks, awards, almost two decades of travel and memorable meals. Here's what I rarely mentioned. Scribbled skull and bones warnings affixed to pots in my grandmother's communal apartment kitchen, where comrade residents pilfered one another's soup meat. The afternoons of me desperately gagging on caviar at my kindergarten for the offspring of the Central Committee, gagging because along with the elite party fish eggs, I felt I was ingesting the very ideology my anti-Soviet mom couldn't stomach. Nor did I mention the girls' bathroom at School 110, where I, a 9-year-old fledgling black marketeer in a scratchy brown uniform, charged my Soviet classmates 5 kopecks to touch the bottle of Coca-Cola that friends had brought us from the mythical Zagranitsa, abroad. Nor my present-day impulse to steal every last croissant from the splendid free breakfast buffets at the lovely hotels where I often stay for my work. What would be the point of confessing my constant feeling of inhabiting 2 parallel food universes, one where degustation menus at places like Per Se or Noma are routine, the other where a simple banana, a once-a-year treat back in the USSR, still holds an almost talismanic sway over my psyche. The stories I've kept to myself are the stuff of this book. Ultimately, they're why I really write about food. but they aren't just my stories. For any ex-citizen of a 300 million strong Soviet superpower, food is never a mere individual matter. In 1917, bread riots sparked the overthrow of the Tsar, and 74 years later, catastrophic food shortages helped push Gorbachev's floundering empire into the dustbin. In between, 7 million people perished from hunger during Stalin's collectivization. 4 million more starved to death during Hitler's war. Even in calmer times under Khrushchev and Brezhnev, the daily drama of putting a meal on the table trumped most other concerns. Across 11 time zones, the collective socialist fate of standing in food lines united comrades from the Union's 15 ethnic republics. Food was an abiding theme of Soviet political history, permeating every nook and cranny of our collective unconscious.
We've just heard Mastering the Art of Soviet Cooking by Anya von Bremsen. According to Asif Manvi, his father moved their family to the United States because of a word. It was a word whose meaning fascinated him. It was a singularly American word, a fat word, a word that could only be spoken with decadent pride. That word was brunch. The beauty of America, Asif's dad would say, is that they have so much food that between breakfast and lunch, they have to stop and eat again. If you're an Indo-Muslim British-American actor who has spent more time in bars than mosques, it turns out it's a little tough to explain who you are or where you're from. In No Land's Man, a perilous journey through romance, Islam, and brunch, Asif, who performs the book, explores this and other conundrums through stories about his family, ambition, and culture tales that range from being a high school-age Michael Jackson impersonator to joining a Bible study group in order to seduce a nice Christian girl to improbably becoming America's favorite Muslim, Indian, Arab, brown doctor correspondent on The Daily Show with Jon Stewart.
My family left the northern English textile factory town of Bradford and moved to America in the early 1980s when I was 16 years old. It happened so fast that I never really had a chance to say a proper goodbye to the place where I spent my childhood. As a teenager, you tend to focus on the future rather than the past, and because my life after college and in New York was busy and full, I never had a desire to return. This actually might not come as a surprise to anyone who has ever lived in Bradford, for until my parents saved up enough money to move us to the suburbs, we lived against the backdrop of factories, mills, graffiti-ridden tenement buildings, and run-down council estates. I remember the entire city looking like it was covered in soot. However, 16 years later, now living in New York and working as an actor, I'd recently closed a successful run of my one-man show, Sakina's Restaurant, which I had written and performed at the American Place Theater in New York City after several years of development. The play was critically well-received, and it ran for almost 6 months in the tiny black box theater below 46th Street. It was the culmination of several years of hard work for me, with write-ups in the New York Times and movie directors and VIPs coming to see me perform. It was my first brush with success in a business that I'd been struggling to make it in for almost a decade. Through the process of workshopping the play, performing, and rewriting it, I managed to excavate what I thought was the story of my immigrant experience. As solo shows often are, it was a personal and cathartic performance and became a way for me to examine how my own issues of identity and dislocation had affected me. As I performed the play every night, I had the sense that I had uncovered something that had lain dormant in me for a long time, and I could not put it back to sleep. The play that I thought would put the pieces of my dislocated identity together actually just shone a spotlight on the pieces that were missing, and I realized after some time of denying it that those pieces were back in Bradford. I began to feel nostalgic for the city of my childhood. I thought about returning to the house that I grew up in, my middle school and boarding school, the reservoir where I went sledding as a child, my dad's corner shop, and the makeshift little children's theater where I first discovered my love of being a performer. This feeling came about suddenly, and I couldn't really understand it or afford it, honestly. Traveling to England is expensive for anyone, especially someone making an off-Broadway theater actor's salary. My opportunity to return presented itself serendipitously a few months later. After one of the performances, a screenwriter friend mentioned my show to the famed Indian film director Shekhar Kapoor. Shekhar and I became friends, and for a while thereafter he would buy me lunch whenever he was in New York. He also happened to be working with Andrew Lloyd Webber on what would later become the musical Bombay Dreams. During one of our lunches in New York, he mentioned Sid Montan, a festival that Andrew put on every year at his country estate. Shekhar thought that my show would be perfect for the festival, and he told me that if I came out to England, he would set up a meeting. It would be a wonderful addition, and I'm sure Andrew would be very excited, he said. As I left the restaurant, I marveled at the strange circumstance that was about to accompany my return to England. It felt somehow fated. I didn't sing, and the only Webber musical I had ever seen was Jesus Christ Superstar, so being invited back to England in this manner felt akin to being invited to Rome to meet with the Pope. You kind of have to stop making excuses and just go. Returning to England in this way also felt like a tremendous accomplishment. It would be a triumphant return, I thought. The little Indian kid from Bradford who was called a wog and chased home from the bus stop every night, returning to perform his Toast of New York play about being an Indian immigrant for the British aristocracy. I was pretty chuffed with myself. As I walked around my apartment for several days singing Asif Manvi, Superstar, I'm gonna be best friends with Lloyd Webber. Several weeks later, I found myself sitting in the offices of the Really Useful Group, Andrew Lloyd Webber's headquarters in London. His associate finally came back into the office with an apologetic look on his face. "I'm so terribly sorry," he said, "but Andrew has to leave. He feels dreadful for making you wait, but something has come up and he has to dash. When do you go back to New York?" "The day after tomorrow," I said, standing up and gathering my things. "Oh, that's too bad," he said as he led me to the door. "He has time next week, but you won't be here." I could tell from his tone that he had more important things on his plate than talking to some unknown actor from New York.
We've just heard No Land's Man, A Perilous Journey Through Romance, Islam, and Brunch by Asif Manvi. Readers, I want to thank you for journeying along with me this year through the incredible literary landscape. There have been so many fabulous discoveries, new authors, and new titles from our favorites. It certainly makes me look forward to the year ahead. Wishing you a happy, healthy new year filled with every good thing and many happy hours with a great book. Let's meet again in a week to kick off the new year together with the next edition of The Book Report.